Actually, and thank you very much for staying around, for having me, especially because it feels like the temperature is dropping. What is happening? So I'm a friend of Timothy's. I live in Boston, and I'm a director of a campus ministry called New Humanity Institute. But I'm not here to talk about that so much as to just talk about, I think, practical ways to live out the gospel, especially as it relates to social justice. Is that right? Well, I don't know what's going on. So that's what I think I'm here to talk about. I wanted to just share two things and then field some questions from you, because I want to be relevant and as practical. Actually, three things. So here they are. So keep this in your mind, and then we'll, I'll give brief descriptions of these three things, and then you tell me what questions you have and what you'd like me to answer. Cool question. And so the first one is intentional Christian community. The second one is addressing mass incarceration. And the third one is economic discipleship. Okay, so let me give you some description of each of those three things. The first one is intentional Christian community. So I came to Jesus in Los Angeles, California, and there were some people that were very instrumental in that, in witnessing to me. I would call one of them, especially my spiritual mom, Gail Yoshimine, and her husband John Yoshimine. They lived in intentional Christian community in the suburbs of Anaheim, California. Now, they lived with two of their adult friends, Bryce and Bruce, and I was really touched by this because I'd never seen anything like that before. Any kind of like Christian adults living together. You know, I was raised in a home where we had our two-car garage, and it was just my parents, me, and my younger sister. So to see Christians living in this way, where they shared a house, and also John and Gail had a son, they had just had a son. I had never seen that, and yet it made a lot of sense to me, because one of those guys, Bryce, he had been an engineer, but always felt like he wanted to work with young people, high schoolers. But he wanted to be a teacher and was never able to until they moved in all together as a community into this house where they can afford it, right? He could afford it on a teacher's salary. And so anyway, I saw all this and I said, this is crazy, right? Like, you're crazy. You have these tamale-making parties every New Year where everyone comes over. I would go over because, all the time, because my parents were having a rocky time and there was always someone to talk to. Folks taught me how to play guitar when I was hanging out there. And it made such an impact on me as a late high schooler that after I graduated from college, I moved into an apartment where it was basically a kind of a Mexican immigrant community. And then others moved in with me, and we formed our own kind of Christian community, and we served that community. I was being mentored by a couple. They had a Spanish-speaking Bible study. I played guitar, so, I helped out with worship for that. But where we lived, we turned our two-bedroom apartment into a computer center, a homework center, a little library, arts and crafts. And we would have kids over all the time, like after we got home from work, and the kids were home from school. And then later on, actually opened this up, one of the bedrooms, to a young family with two kids. That that was fun for me because I learned a lot about myself and about this community. Kind of a funny story related to that was, as I moved in, I would tell, these families, the kids and the adults, that my name's Mako. And I would get funny looks, right? Because, they had never probably met a Japanese-American person before. But also, my name was somehow really interesting to them. And a few of the kids would laugh. They're like, "Your name's Mako?" I was like, so I went back to my mentors and I said, "You know, what's the deal with my name? Like, why does it make people laugh?" And they said, "Oh, you know why? It's because in Spanish, Mako is very close to the word moco, which is Spanish for boogers." So I was like, "Oh, well, that's a bummer. Should I go by my full name, which is Makoto?" And, you know, I have gone through this whole personal process with my name, right? Like, because being raised in this kind of mostly non-Asian community where it is just unusual to have, you know, a non-Anglo name, I just had to come to peace with that. And so I finally did in college because I found out that Makoto is the Japanese word for truth. And so the New Testament translated into Japanese when Jesus says, "I'm the way, the Makoto," and he says, "I'm the way, the truth, and life," "I'm the Makoto." I was like, "Oh, that's cool. I like that." So I was like, "Oh, should I, in the Spanish-speaking community, should I go by my full name, Makoto?" And they said, "Well, no, you don't want to do that. Because in Spanish, when you finish a word with ito, it means small. When you finish it with oto, it means big. So Makoto is close to Mokoto, which is big boogers." So I got this real taste of, wow, this is what Jesus, a little bit of what Jesus experienced, right? Like, he goes from being in the form of God to being in the form of a human being. No one really knows who he is, appreciates who he is, and I get a little taste of that. A little taste. But it was a wonderful experience. And I was introduced to Ming, who later became my wife, because both of us had an interest in intentional Christian community, especially in urban settings. And now we got married in 99, and we bought a house in 2000 in this lower income, high crime area of Dorchester. And along the way, it's kind of in this, I'm trying to describe it. It's not a pretty house. It's just kind of straight up rectangular box type house. It was built for a lower income Irish community in the 1920s. And since then, our neighborhood has become, you know, it transitioned. It was Jewish in like the 50s, and then it was African American in about the 60s and 70s. And then it's very diverse now. There's 4 languages spoken, you know, English, Spanish, Haitian Creole, Jamaican Patois. It's just very diverse. And so we moved in there in 2000. We invited a whole bunch of other folks at different times to live with us. We wanted to be a Christian community. So we had like Bible club for kids. We started a community garden right next door because my wife and others got grants to turn this vacant lot into a beautiful garden where the older folks came out and planted their greens and beans and tomatoes, and we just had a great time getting to know them. We were able to pay youth a stipend to help us out because of the grant. Out of that flowed a neighborhood women's Bible study, a neighborhood monthly meeting, which was kind of a crime watch because there were drug houses on our street. And, you know, like just prayer times and all these things. There, we also had some green space in that garden so that we could set up a screen, a projector, speakers, and we had family movie nights every Thursday night during the summers. Between 20 to 50 people would come out in the neighborhood. It was just a lot of fun. And we have seen God move. We've seen a physical healing of this drug dealer, and also just amazing things in the lives of people we love. And when I stand here before you, I really want to emphasize that I get to represent a lot of precious people and amazing people. And you know, when I tell these stories, I wish that you could see all these folks. Because it's not me. It's the Lord, and it's a lot of people, and it's I just get to be the person who tells you these stories, right? But we have learned a lot about how to live as a community, because that's not easy, and especially when there's stresses and strains from inside and outside. So how to do good conflict reconciliation in a godly way, how to reach out to neighbors in a godly way. And I've been really fortunate because one of my former housemates, Leslie, she got a vision from this to buy property of her own. So she bought a house up the street. It's another three-decker. And she turned it into a residential discipleship house, where young people ages 18 to 25 can come and live there if they are getting their GED or putting their way through school or putting themselves through school or trying to hold down a job. And it's addressing things like just emotional stability or maybe getting clean from substances and stuff like that. Another friend of ours, she was also inspired, and she bought a house around the corner. And she turned it into a young women's discipleship house, especially young moms. And so young mothers with their children were welcome to come and live there. And, same basic idea. It's a residential Christian discipleship program. And, I've gotten to see a bunch of cool things like that. So I wanted to put that out there. That was number one topic that you could ask me more about. If you are interested in things like that, how does that happen? What if you where did you find the people? If you wanted to refer other people to talk to me, then you can tell me that too. But that's a really important thing, because we started to learn that the beauty of community is really it shines in situations like this, and also it's really practical. So my wife and I have raised our two kids, in this setting, and it's been great for them. It's been great. So I could answer questions about parenting as well. Like, how does this work as parents? So that's one thing. Second thing that I'm happy to talk to you more about is, mass incarceration. So many of you know, especially if you live near Baltimore or just have just been in touch with the news, that the long history of this country, especially in regards to race, and more recently the war on drugs, has put a lot of people behind bars. And the penalties were stiff, and especially as it has impacted the black community, and to some degree the Latino community. The issues of the police, differently police community, black communities, we differently prosecute, differently sentence, and also once people get out of prison, even if they are a non-violent drug offender, right, they carry with them this record where sometimes, depending on the state, you lose your voting rights, you lose any food stamp benefits, housing benefits, which makes it really hard if I'm the one coming out of prison and I want to get back with my wife and kids or girlfriend and kids, but if I do that, they will also lose those benefits, right? So there are now economic disincentives to reunite families after all of that. And on top of that, in many places, you got to check the box that says, when I'm applying for a job, yes, I have this felony record, which in many cases just disqualifies you right away. Yeah, Second Amendment rights. So the question is, when do we believe people are done, right? Like just owing their debt to society and paying their time. And so after reading a book called The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, my pastor and I developed a curriculum using that book, and it's a 5 to 8 week curriculum focusing on scripture and the character of God, because that book, because the issue is, or at least part of the issue is, that one of the reasons why in the U.S. we lock people up so much is because we have this Puritan theology and this Puritan image of a punitive God, of a punishing God. Right, and then we model the criminal justice system after that image. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And so if we are really going to change completely, you know, how we deal with this and how we can deal with these problems of privatized prisons, essentially, or mass incarceration, where, you know, now there's economic incentives for these privatized prisons to contract out prison labor for cheap, 17 cents an hour, right? To women's lingerie companies, to telemarketing, to computer manufacturing, like all that gets done in-house now, and there's strong economic incentives to keep people locked up, to not be rehabilitative, but actually to just have this steady flow of basically newly enslaved labor, right? This is what we're doing. If we're ever going to change that, we need a vision of God as restorative. That God's highest justice is a restorative justice. That God is not happy nor satisfied when he just gets to pour out his wrath on people and say, well, that makes me feel great. But instead, God's love is always moving people into restoration, into the people that he has always wanted for them to be. And we see that in Jesus. Jesus has perfected a new humanity for us so that we might participate in that, in him, by his Spirit. And so if we believe that, then we must believe that God is restorative, and then we must believe that we need to design all of our institutions in society around a restorative justice. Can you say amen to that?
Amen.
Is this, are you feeling it? Are you feel, this is how it must work.
Of course.
And so when we read about all these issues of the new Jim Crow, mass incarceration, Black Lives Matter, these, we have to be responding from a view of God as restorative. And then, boy, there's a lot of work to do. So anyway, there's this curriculum that I have, and I've used it in my church, and boy, let me just say, that experience over the summer was so, it was fun on one level, it was sobering on another level, of course, because the topic is serious, right? But the fun part was, we got new people coming to our small group almost every week, because they were like, wait, you're Christians and you're talking about this? Let me come. We got a person who was a CNN reporter, manages like the website of the CNN.com, saying like, wow, I wanna hear more about this. She identified as Jewish, she's a friend of ours, and so she came. Another time we got this couple who marched with Dr. King in the 60s. And they go now to a Unitarian Universalist church, but they, which I don't know exactly what that means, but they, and what they believe, but they, what impressed me about them was they had marched with Dr. King. They said, what you're doing is so cool. Like, you know, you're studying this, and we were writing letters to Obama, to our congresspeople, you know, because there's bipartisan support to peel back a lot of the excesses of the war on drugs and to address criminal justice. And so they said, what you're doing is really cool. We don't see a lot of people doing that. I'm like, well, thanks. I'm really honored. But I think what you did was really cool. Like, how does this compare? Writing a few letters, how does that compare with actually marching? But I was really blessed and encouraged to do that. And they got to taste a little bit of, well, if we believe that God is restoring human beings through Jesus and in Jesus, then we need to think about that. So that was cool. And then we had a young woman who unfortunately had some encounters with the police herself down in the South. Boy, that was just hard to hear. But she decided to make our church her church home, because she's like, you guys deal with real issues. So anyway, I just want to say, it doing this kind of curriculum and connecting it to Jesus, and seeing it in the light of Jesus, really serves multiple purposes. It serves our own souls and our development. It serves Christian social justice. It serves evangelism. And it's pretty awesome. So I've been using this at Harvard. It's been stirring up really good conversation. Some of my staff that I am mentoring at Princeton, Tufts, Duke, they have started using it. And you know what's really interesting at Princeton is that my guy Eddie, some of you know Eddie, but the he's there as a Princeton Seminary student. This is his first year, and so he visited some of the on-campus Christian fellowships, and he heard two talks at two different fellowships basically saying, you need to take seriously God's retributive justice. Retributive justice, right? Like, God punishes sin, and then he's satisfied, and there's no other way for him to be satisfied. And he was like, oh, gosh, do we really need this here? It is imperative that we put forward an alternative vision, the older understanding of God, that God is restorative. He is not satisfied by just punching someone. And we cannot be satisfied with a criminal justice system that just punishes people and keeps punishing them. When are those people done paying for their crimes? So I just want to commend. I just wanted to commend that to you. At least make you aware that it's out there. If you wanted to ask more questions about it or use it and stuff like that, you could ask me more questions. Okay. The third thing that I could talk about with you is economic discipleship. So a number of years ago, a friend of mine, who is now a professor at Denver Seminary and a senior pastor at a church in Berkeley, California, he and I got together and said, there is nothing around to help Christians develop the gift of giving. The gift of giving. You know, Paul names that as a spiritual gift in Romans 12. Giving financially is a spiritual gift. And yet, we know where to go if we wanted to develop the gift of teaching or, you know, pastoring. You'd go to Grace Seminary, right? Or some kind of seminary. Or if you wanted to develop the gift of evangelism, there are places or people that you could identify as, oh, you're a good evangelist. I want to study from you. I don't know who that is. Ravi Zacharias, right? Billy Graham, maybe in past generations. And so maybe, yeah, sure. So if you wanted to develop those gifts, you know where to go. Where would you go to develop the gift of giving? Yeah. Scripture, you know, but kind of, you're on your own. You're on your own, which is amazing. Which is also to say that we have, in American culture and many other cultures, this fear of talking about money openly. The fact, I'm going to drop something on you. I make about $40,000 a year. And if I brought my full slides, I could show you my spreadsheet, which will show you, like, this is where the money goes in my family, this is where we give, and all those kinds of things. I did that at my church, and people were like, I can't believe you just said that. What? Why? It's because money is such an emotional topic in the U.S. Our identity is so tied to it. We don't know how to handle it. When the fact that I'm a complete stranger to most of you, and I just told you how much I make, you probably feel a little weird about that. Why? Have we removed our financial decisions from Christian accountability? Yeah, because we're so uneasy with money-related topics. And we just don't know how to handle it when, you know, someone is obviously making a lot more and someone is making a lot less. How do we bring people together? How do we have transparency? Don't the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit have transparency? Yeah, they do. So how do we bring this part of our life into the culture of the Trinity? The only way that I know how is to focus on the gift of giving, because we need to think about it like we're developing a muscle. You know, when you go to the gym, do you want to walk out of the gym feeling just the same way that you walked in? Well, hopefully not. Because that would mean that you didn't do anything. You want to walk out of the gym feeling like, there's some soreness. I feel a little hurt, but that's good. Because that's what it ought to feel like if you are appropriately growing. Appropriately grow. You shouldn't mess yourself up. You shouldn't like try to bench press your weight the first time you go there. That would totally tear you apart. You should not. But you need to know how to begin. And then when you see other people there at all kinds of levels of personal health and fitness, you know, someone who is totally fit and someone who is totally not. Maybe they're in rehab. Maybe they're, you know, morbidly obese. Whatever. Do you make fun of those people who are less? No, of course not. You don't. Because well, I hope you don't. Because this is good. This is healthy. It's something you want to encourage everyone to do. And giving is like that. The gift of giving is like that. And so Paul says in 2 Corinthians 8:9, he became poor for our sakes that we might become rich in him. How many layers of that is true? How many ways is that true? Oh, man. And so we want to be more and more like Jesus. And we believe that giving is a muscle. It's a spiritual muscle that we have to develop in community. And transparency is helpful to that because that's the only way we develop. And so we have to be oriented towards a bigger goal. We have to help the poor around the world, and make it so that it's not just about us, and we can acknowledge that there are all these funny feelings that happen in us when we share our salaries, we share our budgets, and we talk about, like, where does the money go? All these funny feelings that come up. Let's acknowledge them. Oh, yeah, yeah. But this is for something greater, and I need your encouragement, and I need to encourage you, right, regardless of where we're at. So my friend Gary and I put together a curriculum. Because we pulled together, let me tell you a little bit more of the story. We pulled together our wives and then 10 other people, so 14 people total. We met once every month, and these folks from different churches, once a month for a Saturday morning. And we would share like our budgets and our best practices for saving money. So, you know, one thing that I learned, because I thought I was really good at saving money. I cut my own hair. My wife says, yeah, people could tell. But, so that saved me, what, 10 bucks a month at least. And yet there was this other family that said, yeah, we only fly in ways where we can get bumped off. You know, so we will buffer the time, that the way that we fly on airplanes so that we could get bumped off. And then they get extra mileage points. And they have flown around the world. They had not paid for an airline flight for like 2 years. I was like, wow, that's incredible. They've saved thousands of dollars. And so we shared all our best practices like that. And we saved. We decided, okay, we're going to save money for a year, for the time that we do this. And then in the last half of our meetings, the last six meetings, what we did was, okay, we are going to be able to save, we determined, $40,000 as a group of 14 people. You know, maybe eight households, I think. But eight households coming together, we saved $40,000. This is not instead of our normal church giving, right? Like this is, we didn't shift money like that. This is on top of just whatever things that we have going already. This is what we learned from each other and what we're able to put into practice. And we had, I mean, there were some challenges too. Like, all right, I'm going to commit to only going to the movie theaters twice a year because it's just not worth it, right? Like, and I'm going to save. So if that hurts a little bit, good. Because this is like going to the gym. Right, you don't want to come out of the gym feeling like, oh, I just feel the same way. What's the use of that? And yet, you want to do something that is personal to you. There isn't a one size fits all, but we do have to ask, what is the next step for me? How can I continue to challenge myself and develop that spiritual muscle So we did these things. We wound up giving $40,000 to five different organizations around the world working in the field of global poverty, relief, development, microfinance, which I'd love to tell you about. And part of that experience was we did some research, and each of us kind of came with a favorite organization that we wanted to put before the group and really be advocates for. And it got our blood going. There were some things that I learned about Christian organizations, and some non-Christian too, but mostly Christian organizations working around the world that was so exciting. I was tempted to just turn to my wife and say, let's drop everything and move, move. And I am a cynical person. I usually do not get really impressed easily. And I like my job and my life, so I don't feel that kind of thing very easily either. But what I learned from the quality of work being done, I was just so impressed. And so Gary and I packaged that experience, and we talked to a group called the Boston Faith and Justice Network, which is a network of churches in Boston, and we said, hey, can we make you aware of this? And they said, we were looking for something like this. And as of December of last year, according to the BFJN, this curriculum has been used since 2007 to mobilize $750,000 from Christians in first-time use. That's right. I'm really rooting for us to reach a million. And that's only in Boston. I know it's been used around the country, but right now we just don't have any way of keeping track of that. But we need a context in which we can develop the gift of giving. Because Jesus calls for it, because the world needs it, and because it's healthy for us. Okay. So those are the three things that if you wanted to ask me more about, I'm happy to talk about. Intentional Christian community, mass incarceration, and kind of getting involved in politics, or at least advocacy, and economic discipleship.
Before you get started, what's a little background about you and where you came from, where you went to school? How did you end up, from California to Boston?
Yeah. So, I was born in Los Angeles in 1972. My parents were Japanese Americans. My mom immigrated from Japan in 1963. My dad, his parents immigrated in a generation before that. I did not grow up in a Christian family. Three good friends of mine just were very faithful in caring for me. They were Christians. And so I gave my life to Jesus in high school. Went up to the Bay Area in Northern California. I went into Stanford for undergrad, graduated in 94, and then met my wife on a blind date in 98. She was living in the Boston area, and so we dated long distance for a while, and we connected about a lot of things, love for scripture, love for children, love for urban ministry, and so we got married in 99, and I did some work in the marketplace at Intel and in two startup companies. Both of them were trying to bring technology jobs to urban areas. And then in 2001, I got involved in campus ministry. And so that kind of catches you up. So that's a little bit of my history. Thank you for asking. And let's see, what else? You know what?
You're in North Carolina?
Boston. Yep. Yes, hand right here, and then go over here. Yeah.
What you're talking about with regard to restorative, God is restorative, and really taking seriously putting Jesus's admonitions into action, that's scary to a lot of people. That's taking the words of the Declaration at heart, which is not what the government wants us to do with regard to really holding our politicians accountable. I applaud you for that. You know, I applaud you for that. You know, these are subjects that are deeply emotional to a lot of people. You know, and when you said, "Do you feel it?" Yes, I do feel it. You know, because wrong is wrong, especially when it comes to mass incarceration. And Michelle Alexander's book is fantastic because it really documents, you know, a institutional problem that we have to address. You know, this, I believe, like you said, really stirs up God and really makes him mad, because we shouldn't mistreat each other, you know? And he hates an unjust balance. So thank you for what you're doing. And, pardon me?
Thanks for your encouragement.
Yes, I'll stop.
Yes?
Yeah, my name is Bill. I wrote a paper in college almost 20 years ago now in a sociology class about this very same problem. Mm-hmm. And in the presentation of the problem mass incarceration has been a problem. The numbers are almost exponential from the 60s on, especially with the war on drugs. And you can be found guilty of second-degree murder and receive a lighter sentence than a nonviolent drug offender.
Right.
And it's insane. So in this paper, what I wrote was that our prison system is broken because it is, like you say, retributive. But why not have a prison system where people are put to work, not as forced labor, because, you know, the 13th Amendment abolishes slavery, but there's a provision. It says forced labor is now illegal, save for punishment. All right, and so that's being exploited. It's not being used the way the 13th Amendment intends it to be used. So in my paper, I wrote, why not have a prison system where these people are put to work and taught a skill, right? And get this, they're paid a wage. They're paid a fair hourly wage, and they get 25% of that to spend at a store inside the prison. They can buy their cigarettes or whatever they want, you know, what their magazines, whatever they're interested in. And then 75% of that is held in an interest-bearing account. So at the end of their sentence, they got a road stake. Here's $50,000 that you earned. Now go start over and take this trade that you've learned, so you don't have to sell. You don't have to, you know, you have an education, whether it's a technical education or an academic education, but something that you can take away from this experience to restore you in your life, and not just hope you come back so we can use you to make more whatever.
Yeah. Well, Bill, you were a few decades ahead of your time. Can you send me that paper? Because I think that's a beautiful vision. And I think that's one of many things that we ought to be considering. Like, how do we plan for reintegration? For people to be reintegrated with their families and their communities. We've got to think like that. Yeah? So that is the beginning.
Sir.
Yes, yes. Floyd.
My name is Floyd Craig, and I work with the juvenile justice system in the District of Columbia. I'm retired now, but not retired, I'm just at this place for you.
This is important. I want you to be on the mic.
Yeah. But
closer to you.
These are things we as therapists and social workers always address. But no one has ever answered the question. Drugs comes into this country. The young people are not bringing it in. So we need to look at the source from which these drugs come into this country and who is allowing it to come in, and the youth are paying the penalty. Because they can't sell what they are not given. If they don't have access to sell drugs, drugs would not be on the street. Now, someone in this nation and in this world is making a profit off the lives of our youth globally, not only here in America, but worldwide. And this is something that needs to be addressed, and we need to bring this forth to our candidates who run it for the election, because right now this world is in a terrible position, especially with youth being killed and incarcerated. And then you got whole families are being incarcerated. The children are suffering, the grandparents are raising them, and they don't know what to do with them. And the schools is reaping all the benefits of it. So somewhere along the line, we as adults have to come to our senses, look at what Jesus Christ is doing in this world, and follow him, because Jesus is not of what is going on. He's here, just like you say, to restore it. But we got to be his hands and his feet. We cannot sit back any longer and allow this blood to continue to flow through this nation and the world, because we are sinning by omission, not stepping up to the plate, not willing to put our lives on the line for the truth. And somewhere we got to do it. We got to bear the brunt
right of
it. Thank you.
Thank you, Sister Floyd.
I'm not going to stand. My name is Leela Hansard, and I'm from Columbia, South Carolina. And I've been involved with the criminal justice system as a parent. My son was incarcerated as a youth and as an adult. And I also worked for the criminal justice system. I needed a job. My son discouraged me from going, but I needed the benefits. And I stayed 13 years. The criminal justice system starts off with our youth. Then it goes on up. When that youth don't see benefits, he ends up in the adult system. Then what? He gets out. He has to check that box that says, have you ever committed a felony? Then what? You know, people who don't have people that have been through this, they look at them like, oh, well, they got what they deserve. Have you ever done anything? Did you got what you deserve? Then, you know, people get out, they have children. My son told me before I came up here, he has to pay $63,000 for child support. He said, Mom, I'll never do this. I'll never get away from this. He's talked to people in South Carolina, and they are giving him an appointment or something else. They don't intend for you to succeed. And again, not just with the youth, because the youth go into the adult. If you go into the adult prisons, you'll find out how many adults was in the youth system. Some of the people that were incarcerated, that I was involved with women. When you talk to them, they were the youth, in a youth place. Some of them I still communicate with. Why? People say, oh, you still talk to them? Because something I can do or say that can help them. You know, so we gotta, you know, I don't know the answer, I really don't. You know, but I know being harsh and being negative toward them, that's not gonna work. Again, I did it as a parent, and I did it as an employee. So, and I watch a lot of those people turn away from those lockup. watch those programs. Have some empathy for those people. No, we're not going to reach all of them, but we may reach some of them. If you know somebody that's incarcerated, write them. I mean, think of how many people we know in here that know somebody that's incarcerated. Write them. I mean, it's sad. But people only don't think about it until it touches you. But it's been touching me since my son's been 15 years old, and now he's 48. Thank you.
Hello and welcome back to Maryland. Nice seeing you again.
Thank you.
I'm really interested in the economic discipleship, and it seems like that just really is saying something to me, because I have, there's a hobby that I have, and people who know me in the church, they've heard this many times. I call it finding the money. And basically what it is trying to find money without having to get a second or third job. Of course, if you want to do that, you can do that, but my thing is we overpay for things. And just an example, this whole weekend, with our family, Discover Card is paying for our whole trip, and that's based on rebates. So, and I like to help my friends, people at work, find those things that you're overpaying for. And just like with, there's some utilities, if you pay them every month, you're paying more. If you pay it once a year, you get a discount. And a lot of people don't know that. So there's different things that I've discovered over the years just from asking questions or, you know, doing research. And I try to share that with my friends and family so that, you know, they can not pay more money for things than you have to. So when you were talking about that, I was like, oh yeah, this is something that I would definitely be interested in, and learning more about that so that you can try to incorporate that more in our family and just with friends, church, whatever. Even people at work, I've talked to them about different things that they can do. And the thing about it is, once people figure out that they're paying more or there's different things they can do, and just by asking certain questions, it just takes off. I don't even have to tell them much more what to do, because they just get it, and then they just start changing their habits or different things. But they basically can do the same thing that they've been doing or more, you know, just by rethinking how to, you know, pay for things or not pay for things.
That's really wonderful, because credit cards are actually, in general, a way that banks and other credit companies transfer wealth from poorer families into the rich banks, right? Because all the benefits that you speak of, they generally give to people with, you know, good credit. But if a person or a family has bad credit, or they are, you know, are behind in their payments, they're paying interest rates of like 18 to 25%. And so there's a friend of mine is a research economist for the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, and he wrote a paper on how credit card companies and ATM fees and all these things are actually ways that wealth gets transferred from the poor to the rich. So I think the church community, we have to be on top of that. We have to warn people about, like, hey, you have to be financial literacy and being able to budget and be disciplined, and, you know, and just get out of credit card debt. And then also, like, but if there are ways to save money, to, you know, just to do that, we really need to do that. And so we need more forums where we're practically helping each other practically. Do you know that Sunday school originated not as Bible studies? It was when the printing press made books very accessible. And so Sunday schools in churches were actually for literacy. And they became Bible studies, generally speaking. And I'm glad for that. But, you know, it was the people of God saying that, hey, we need a lot of help here. There are certain changes that happen in society, and we need for people to be literate about them. And so now that it's financial literacy and technical literacy, there's a big question of, like, is the church really stepping in a thoughtful way? So this is one way in which we can do that. Yes?
Just another small comment. If I can encourage everybody to hear one speech or read the speech, it would be The Drum Major Instinct by Dr. King.
The Drum Major Instinct.
Drum Major Instinct. He addresses exactly what you're talking about. He addresses why probably Bill's great idea does not want to be embraced.
Mm.
He addresses, well, in a nutshell, the Drum Major Instinct is everybody wants to be the drum major out in front. Everybody wants to be the leader. It's on a personal basis. It's on a job basis, and he addresses it on a national basis. And that's when he also talked about America being in Vietnam and how wrong that was and everything that we were doing wrong
yep.
there.
Yep.
So the Drum Major Instinct, and he also addresses economic disparities like you're addressing.
Great, thank you for that reference. I had not heard of that, so I will go home and check it out. Thanks. Yes.
This lady from Columbia, South Carolina.
Yeah.
We had a young man in our church that was in the military.
Can you hear him a little?
Yeah, I'm sure she can hear me. I'm pretty loud. We had a young man in our church. He was in the military and he got in trouble.
Hey Bill, are we recording that?
Are we recording?
Yeah. Yes.
So we need you on the
mic. All right.
Yeah.
I just wanted to share something with you. We had a young man in our church. He was in the military, and he got in some trouble, and it involved drugs. And he ended up a convicted felon, and he went to a military prison for about 18 months. And most of the folks in our church were just really supportive of the family. But I got wind that there were a few that were a little judgmental about the situation. So I got up in the pulpit, and I wanted you to hear this. When I was a friend, and I told this story, I'll tell it to you. When I was a freshman in college, I had a 1968 Camaro, and I had three buddies with me. And we were leaving Gladewater, Texas, going back to Big Sandy, where the campus was, and I was just showing off to my friends. So I went through a speed trap at 115 miles an hour, and I saw the blue lights come on, but give me a break. You can't catch a car from a dead stop that's going 115. So I didn't stop. And when I pulled into campus, the campus security asked me to wait. And the campus police came and they said, hey, the Gladewater police clocked you at 112 miles an hour. And they're going to arrest you tonight for felony eluding and evading. But because Ambassador College had such a good reputation in the community, they set up a roadblock in the next town. They called ahead, because you know the old saying, you can outrun Ford, Chevy, and Chrysler, but you can't outrun Motorola, right? So they radioed ahead. There was a roadblock waiting for me, but before I got to the town of Big Sandy, I pulled into our campus. And Mr. Allen was the police officer, and he said, they're going to take you to jail tonight. And when he called him on the radio, he said, I got your red Camaro right here. And the guy came back on the radio and said, is he one of your students? And he said, yeah, he's one of our students. And he said, well, tell him to slow down. So what I'm telling you is that I am an unconvicted felon. And I guarantee you, a lot of people in this room and a lot of people you meet are unconvicted felons. We just didn't get caught. Or we just didn't get punished. So we have no business judging anybody else.
I was just going to make a comment. To
please.
Stan's comment. I was just going to make a quick comment. Bonnie, Paz, and I, we were, when we came back from watching the feeds. We were just having a conversation. And part of this, I think, is, you know, just literacy. But we were talking about the situation at Walmart and how workers are treated, but how many of us still participate and support and go to Walmart because it has the... And I'm not saying that we should or shouldn't go to Walmart. But, you know, that we do go because it benefits us, but on the backs of the employees. So it is something, you know, on a bigger picture that, you know, we just don't take into consideration because we look at ourselves to see what benefits us. And it benefits us to get the cheapest prices, you
right.
know, from certain organizations.
Right, right.
Anyway, just a comment.
No, thank you. And actually part of this economic discipleship curriculum is about being aware of where our food comes from, where our products come from, because it's not always the most loving and gracious thing to just look for cheap prices, right? Because we need to know where these things come from and how people were treated all along the way. You know, up in the New England area, there's a food chain called Market Basket. I don't know if any of you have heard about it, but because I'm pretty sure it's not down here. But anyway, there's a documentary being made about this whole store because they went through a tug of war. There were two cousins who were vying for control over this business, and one wanted to Walmart the company and make it so like they paid people, workers, less. Take away vacation, maternity, you know, all these things, right? Disempower labor. And then the other was the CEO, but he got like ousted from his job by his cousin. And the workers said, we love RDT because he's stuck up for us, he pays us high wages, like it's really great working here. And we're proud of our job, we're proud of our product, and so they all went on strike. And basically, it gave RDT Demoulas the chance to buy the company back and to not go the route of the Walmartization of American companies, meaning there's more support for labor. There's more honoring of that and less of the shareholder and CEO. So I think we have to really think through that, too. And that is part of, you know, the questions I raise in these curriculums. So I think we need to help people have a directional, not draw a line in the sand, but more like, what's the direction that we're growing in? Like, and are there gifts and spiritual muscles that we need to be exercising? And sometimes debating, because I don't know that there are some issues there. It's genuinely hard or unclear, or like, what do I do? And if I'm, you know, in this situation, well, I don't know. So, but we somehow need to be able to have those conversations and encourage each other to press on. Yes.
Good afternoon. My name is Sylvie Van Acker from Fairfax, Virginia.
Hi, Sylvie.
I have a question about when you were talking about sharing your financial situation and your budget. So my question is, when you do that, a lot of people might be judging you. And there's also something in the Bible that says that when you give, let your right hand not know what your left hand is doing. And you have to give in secret, and whatever you give is between you and the Father. So how do you reconcile that in putting out your budget and giving everybody how much you're making and how you spend it?
Great question. When Jesus says that in Matthew 6, it's in the context that basically some of your life needs to be lived in secret. Now, he also talks about praying, fasting, and giving. And the giving that he's talking about is almsgiving. So it's kind of the spontaneous type of giving. Now the reason why so how do we take that? Well, there are times where we pray in public in front of other people, aren't there? There are times where we fast, and at least our families will know, because hey, why didn't you eat with us? You know, like, I mean, we kind of have to explain. So it's not that we have to advertise every single thing. And I think Jesus was really warning us not to live all of our spiritual life out in public for everyone to consume. That is not what we're called to do. There is a part of our life that really needs to be lived in secret before the Father. Having said that, there are other ways that Paul, for instance, knows about the Corinthians and the Philippians being committed to giving some money to the poor, like the Jewish believers in Judea during the famine relief, right? And so Paul knows that they had, so they had communication about that, and I'm guessing that, I mean, I think it's pretty reasonable that they had talked about that as a church community and or as a network of house churches, right? Because otherwise, why would you ask Paul to come visit you and tell him that, hey, we're, you know, like, Paul, you can expect to receive some money for you to take over here if people weren't committed. So I think that there is a care that we need to take for both of those things. That on the one hand, yes, Jesus calls us to do some things in secret, just because the Father loves to share secrets with us. But there are others, especially big decisions, that I think we are called to be transparent about. So if you really want to kind of map this onto your budget, I would just encourage you to say, well, there's a category of your life that is just spontaneous, right? Whether that be spontaneous things that you're planning to give towards, or things that you're planning to, I don't know, buy gifts for other people, and that kind of thing. Things that just come up in life that you're not sure exactly how to budget for them. Just have a category and then say, within that category, that's kind of this area of my life that I live spontaneously with Jesus. Yes?
Yes. One of the difficulties I have with giving, especially with family members, is when you start to give, sometimes you develop, I call it a dependency. You tend to want to expect it and lay down and don't put out their effort. How do you avoid that type of trap?
That's a great question. How do you avoid other people becoming dependent on you? You ask them to be transparent with you about their budget. That's step number one. I think because and then ask them to be transparent with other people as well. Now, that will probably push some buttons, and that's probably, you know, in most situations where it might end. They'd be like, okay, I'm going to ask someone else. But the, you know, I think the only, but, you know, but it is an act of love. And it takes some strength to receive it, right? That, because basically if they really do want to grow, and again, like the grow in both simplicity, generosity, and their ability to be in community, then I think that really helps. You know, there was one young lady who was part of this experience. She used the curriculum, and one of the things that she discovered was she would go into debt because she would always buy things for people. Like, she would treat people at restaurants, and she would do that. And she realized that it touched on a deeper emotional issue for her. She was insecure about some of her friendships, and that's just what she did to make up for it. And you know, Romans 13 is a place where Paul says, basically, don't go into debt. Try to avoid it. Now, that raises other questions, right, about mortgages and educational things. But as far as consumer debt, that I think is pretty clear. We ought not to do that. And so the love of God and the love of the community was there to support her, and she was able to process through that. There were some tears shed on her part, but it was a really good moment. So sometimes, yeah, going through our finances unearths deeper emotional and spiritual issues that we will have to work on. But that's good. And, but again, yeah, will everyone receive it that way? Well, I don't know. But it doesn't stop you from knowing that this is good. Yes.
My name is Maria, and I wanted you to talk a little bit more about intentional Christianity, and how did you go about finding families for the various houses you talked about? Was there any kind of vetting process, or are these individuals that came to your worship services?
Yeah, so the question is, how did we go about building a community, an intentional Christian community? Well, the first thing we did was we identified, like, how many rooms in the house are we going to have, and then we had a, before we bought the house, well, what did we do? Yeah, before we were even looking for a concrete house, we pulled together anyone interested in urban ministry and said, let's do a Bible study together and talk about some of the things that we're hoping for, that we're likely to encounter, and also what kind of roommates are we? So that was our first pool. And then my wife also knew of another person from a church that she went to who had also done things with intentional community. So we kind of just pulled people together. And what we learned was we had to ask people first for a year-long commitment and then a two-year-long commitment. Because our first batch of people were folks right out of college. And, you know, folks right out of college are in a point of transition. Yeah. We're calling it the second adolescence nowadays, right? It's just, who am I? What am I doing? And that's okay. That's not a judgment. That's just a social observation. It's just, yeah, that's reality. And they have to ask those questions. So in some cases, they can't make longer commitments. And so, but for what we hoped for what we're doing, we needed people to make investments in our neighborhood, in one another, and you know, when you're the person being left behind, it's harder. I don't know, you know, many of you probably are parents and you had kids or just people leave the area, friends go to another part of the country or have to, that's harder. Because they usually have something to look forward to, and they're like, next stage in life. You're like, well, I have to re-up and find new friends. And that's just harder. And it is harder for an intentional community to manage that kind of stuff emotionally. So we wound up asking for a two-year commitment. We defined a set of core values so that we could talk about ourselves to other people and introduce our community to others. So anyone interested would get the kind of the introduction. Usually that'd be me doing it, and I would tell a few stories. We would talk about who we wanted to be, the impact that we wanted to see, and then our vetting process was everyone in the house needs to sign off on any new person. Because, you know, one of our housemates was a single mom with a teenage daughter. And so she said, well, it's not just any guy that I'm gonna feel comfortable, you know, living in our household because I have a teenage daughter. And so, you know, is that person mature and things like that? So there were a few people that we said no to based on more, not character, but because they really weren't interested in investing in the neighborhood. Maybe they were looking for a good place to live, and we're glad that they thought that we were, but we weren't just that. All right? And so there was a missional component to how we lived. Not all communities are like that, I just want to say, and I'm not saying that all communities need to have a missional component. Sometimes it's just good to have a community where the focus is more developing people, or nurturing something, or healing, or something like that. So every community kind of needs to decide that, or at least every owner, a person who anchors that community needs to decide what's the focus going to be. And then developing core values and the process of welcoming other people in. I think that's what you need.
Yes.
Thank you. Stan Glass, Woodbridge, Virginia. Marco, you mentioned earlier that you had two startups in your background, I believe.
Yeah.
So what was the most difficult thing about finding this grant for your community? And what were the biggest challenges about shaping how you presented the grant to the government?
So the grant money that we got in order to turn a vacant lot into a community garden, that was the mayor of Boston had a small changes grant in his office. Like, we filled out the application and that was one of them. There was another one, maybe two others. I'm forgetting, so I'm sorry. But I think that, you know, the small changes grant was between $10,000 and $20,000. I think there were some others that we applied to. So I think the total grant money that we were awarded was between $40,000 and $50,000. So that paid for a lot of the trash cleanup, because it was messy, and the building of vegetable beds, putting fences up, putting flowers in, some landscaping, paying youth, and then, you know, paying for some equipment so that we could do things like family moving ice. So all of that went towards it, and then some maintenance as well.
Was there a strict portion that you had to meet in order to shape your grant, in order to present it? I mean, were there things that you had to satisfy besides just applying? Was there anything special?
There were. My wife knows the details, and I'm sorry I don't, but I, roughly speaking, yeah, we had to say, you know, this portion is going to go towards paying youth, this portion is going to go to raw materials, and, you know, so on.
Right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
What time is it, folks?
It's 10 till 2. You're great, so whatever you want.
Okay. Is anyone heading back to the airport in Salisbury? Or towards there? I'm just wondering whether I should have a cab ready for
Marco, I can give you a ride.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
That'd be great. Thanks, Petey. Thanks.
Now, if somebody wanted to learn about that after this, how to contact you?
Yeah.
If someone wanted to contact me after this, how would they do that? Let's see. I think I have a few cards. But essentially, if you want to email me, that would be easiest. If you want to take this down, my email is spelled, it's my name, Mako, M-A-K-O, dot Nagasawa, N, like Nancy, A-G-A-S-A-W-A, @gmail.com. I'd be happy to be in touch with you. My last name, N, like Nancy, A-G-A-S-A-W-A, @gmail.com.
Do you assist others in developing a program? Say, for instance, someone wanted to develop a program, and I have to get with Pasity on this, under the auspices of Grace Communion or even New Life. Would you assist in working with that individual to put together a program to work in the community?
boy. Would I assist in helping an individual under Grace Communion start a program for the community? I'm honored by your question. Without knowing exactly what you're asking for, I would say generally sure. But you know, I don't I don't pretend to be an expert. I just,
knowledge. That's what I'm doing. Knowledge.
Sure, sure. Yeah. And maybe I would refer you to other folks that I know in Boston, because again, I'm just the storyteller here. I'm representing a lot of other people's experience that I know, and I'm blessed to do that. But yeah, I'm happy to help. Yeah. Yeah, Tim.
You mentioned your website.
Yes. My website... Oh, great. My website is nagasawafamily.org. So N-A-G-A-S-A-W-A. Japanese names are actually really easy once you kind of you get that. It's consonant vowel. You know, it's just nagasawafamily.org. And so both curriculums are there: the New Jim Crow curriculum and also the Economic Discipleship curriculum.
What is on the brochure then? What is your WWW Humanity Institute?
New Humanity Institute is a resourcing ministry focused on Nicene Trinitarian theology, much like Grace Communion. And so that's mostly for the campus ministry that I do.
Okay.
Yeah. You're welcome to look at that, but... all the material that's on the New Humanity Institute website is on my family website. Yes?
Charles Walker from New Creation Community Church in Virginia Beach. I'd just like to say I've been to both websites and they're great. That's how I know this guy.
Oh. Well, thank you, Charles. All right. Well, any last questions? If not, we could call it a wrap. Well, let's call it then. So, thank you very much for taking my pleasure.